We have with us live in the studios once again, Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Job, how was your vacation, briefly?
It was lovely.
Lovely. All right.
That's brief.
That's for you. All right. So we're going to start out with, we have an election coming up.
Yeah, we do. It is coming up. August 17th is the due date for the all vote by mail primary. And of course, being the top two primary during the summer, it doesn't really change or resolve very much. It's actually probably one of the more boring elections we've had in a long time. But there are some important races on the ballot, the most important of which being being the U.S. Senate race. So as we are wont to do, Eat the State has come out with its election picks and endorsements this time, with the usual caveats that these are, you know, simply our opinion, and you should do your own research and make up your own mind and use a variety of sources for that. And, of course, that voting doesn't really change a whole lot. It kind of takes getting out and agitating and standing up for your rights to do that. That's not simply checking off a box in the comfort of your kitchen table. But that being said, Patty Murray is up for re-election this year, and the main suspense in this election, if there is any, is how much of a challenge from the right Dino Rossi will face from Clint Didier, who's the Tea Party activist endorsed by Sarah Palin, who's running to him. And of course, Rossi has been frantically moving to his right and trying to appeal to the Tea Party crowd himself in order to cut off DDA's support. He has the backing, of course, of all the Republican Party establishment. The national establishment in D.C. Recruited him to run in the race to begin with, and he's been fairly successful in that. The polling is showing that DDA hasn't picked up that much support at all, which also tends to reinforce the idea, I think, that the Tea Party is much more of a media phenomenon than it is an actual electoral force that's going to change elections. There's always been a conservative wing to the Republican Party, and there always will be. But that said, there isn't that much else going on in this race. There are several other sort of minor candidates who are running against Murray, although nobody who's running to her left that is posing any kind of a major challenge. The main challenge from the left is a guy named Bob Burr, who he's definitely not going to be on the ballot come November. He has had almost no visibility and no money coming in to support his campaign. But, you know, when he's using words like plutocracy to describe how the U.S. Senate works and the job performance of Senator Murray, he's saying some things that need to be said. So, you know, at least for the time being, this will probably be changed when it comes to, Rossi v. Murray in November. But at this point, we'd like to support more of a challenge to the status quo in the two-party systems, and it makes it very difficult to do that with the top two primary in the general election. So for the primary, we're going to endorse Bob Burr for the Senate. There's not a whole lot interesting going on in the congressional races in the House. The only really notable race is on the east side in the District 8, where it's kind of a foregone conclusion that the top two candidates, Suzanne Delbini, is it Delbini or Delbene?
I
don't even know how to pronounce her name, which tells you how much media coverage this has gotten so far, is the Democrat running against Dave Reichert. She's got a fairly good chance come November, but nobody else is going to get on the ballot against those two. So Suzanne is our choice in that race. There are a couple of activists running who, again, won't go through till November. In other races in outlying areas, if you live up north, there's an activist in Bellingham named Larry Kalb, who was actually on this program.
Yeah, Larry Kalb.
Kalb, a couple months ago. He's running against Rick Larson in the district number 2, and he's a good choice. And then Cheryl Crist down in the open seat to replace Brian Baird in district third district around Olympia and Southwest Washington. The primary, locally, the only election of real interest is the Washington State Supreme Court races. And because there aren't multiple candidates in most of these races, this is going to be the election that picks those races for the Supreme Court. Three of them are up for election this year. In position number one, we have Jim Johnson going for re-election. He's the former Tim Iman lawyer who, since his ascension to the Supreme Court 6 years ago, has been a pretty reliable vote for corporate interests. He's getting a very good challenge from a progressive lawyer named Stan Rumbaugh, who we very strongly support in that race. Position number five, Barbara Madsen, is running unopposed for re-election, and as we normally do with unopposed races, we suggest that you skip it because, you know, North Korea has many things to recommend it, but its political system is not one of those things. And then position number six, Richard Sanders, is running for re-election, and I actually kind of like Richard Sanders. He's a conservative, but he's my kind of conservative in that he's a very principled libertarian, and we actually need those kind of perspectives on the Supreme Court, as long as they're not a majority, because he's been very, very good on civil liberties issues and on the intrusion of both corporate and state power. And there are way too many, including liberal, judges and court members who have a real blind spot to, judicial abuses, corporate abuses of power. So, we'd like to have, Sanders stay on the Supreme Court in position number six. All the other court positions are unopposed locally, so skip those. And the state legislature is really kind of a disaster area this year in that there's really nothing in the way of strongly contested races in the city of Seattle itself. There are a couple of races in other outlying suburban districts that are kind of interesting, but within the city itself, the 46th district, which is up in the Shoreline area in North Seattle and South Snohomish County, tells you all you need to know about how the local Democrats work, where the horrible Senator Ken Jacobson is retiring after being in Olympia since basically the days of the Denny Party. And so to replace him, is it going to be an upgrade? No, we're going to get running unopposed Representative Scott White, who was the poster child of the local Democratic establishment when he ran for that open seat on the House side 2 years ago. And to replace him, a guy named David Frocht is also running unopposed for his representative seat. This is how the Democrats treat these seats. They make the decision behind the closed doors, and then they present us with a fait accompli, and then we wonder why we get these Olympia legislators from Seattle who treat their posts like sinecures for life. It's because they are sinecures for life, because they are rarely, if ever, actually contested once they become elected. And there really aren't that many of the people who are up for election. None of them really face any serious challenges. But even of the ones who are being challenged, there are only a handful that we feel strongly enough in a positive sense that we think they deserve a vote for re-election. Those would be Bob Hasegawa and Zach Hudgens, both representatives in the 11th District in South Seattle, Senator Marilyn Chase in the North Seattle in the 32nd, South Seattle Senator Adam Klein in the 37th, and Representative Eric Pettigrew also in the 37th. That's really about it, and I want to separate out for special mention Frank Chop in the 43rd, who is the House Majority Leader, who is much more conservative than his district would lead you to believe. It's one of the more liberal districts in Seattle, but Chop has actually been he basically has to sign off on any bill for it to get through the House, and he has been the main impediment for a lot of progressive legislation being considered in the floor by the Democratic majority in the House of Representatives. And so he needs a challenge. Unfortunately, his only challenge this time is coming from a Republican wingnut named Kim Verde. I would vote for her just because Chop needs to hear that
Chop needs a scare.
That people aren't pleased with him, and he also needs to hear that having a mile long mall to replace the Alaskan Way Viaduct isn't just a bad idea. It's It's something that we expect out of, I don't know, Mike the Mover or some of the other permanent minor candidates, not the guy who's one of the most powerful people in Olympia.
All right. Okay, moving on to developments this week with the Seattle City Council.
Yeah, a City Council committee this week passed legislation on Tuesday to help urban farmers. Included in that legislation provisions that increase the number of chickens that Seattleites can have in each household from 3 to 8. So you can now have 8 chickens in your backyard. But any coop for your chickens needs to be at least 10 feet from your property line. So that might be prohibitive for people who live on smaller property lots. But included in the legislation, they also voted to outlaw roosters. Currently, if you have a rooster, you can keep him until he dies or you take him to the chopping block. But you don't have to take him to the chopping block because the rooster you have is grandfathered in, but you just can't buy any new ones. It does allow taller greenhouses. So greenhouses that are devoted strictly to food production can now be 15 feet above the height limits in certain zones. It also allows farms up to 4,000 square feet in residential zones, and with certain limits, you can also sell your produce on the farm site. So folks who are interested in becoming urban farmers or who are currently urban farmers should check out that new legislation and see what the City Council has done for you. It passed committee, but it will be voted on, I think, next week by the full council and is likely to pass.
And there's a very vibrant and very active urban farming movement in Seattle. It's really nice to see it getting some recognition and some
support
from the City Council.
Mm-hmm. And then on Monday, you know, the City Council, we talked about this a little bit last week, the City Council voted on Monday to approve the resolution to eventually sign agreements with the Washington State Department of Transportation on issues surrounding the downtown traffic tunnel construction to replace the viaduct. But right after they took that vote, the council then started looking at proposals for funding the city's portion of the viaduct replacement costs. The city's costs will be, you know, and I've seen various estimates, somewhere around $750 to $840 million. About $270 million of that is going to be for rebuilding the seawall along the waterfront. About $250 million for relocation of utilities, and the rest is going to be split out between improvements to the Mercer Corridor West, sort of the Mercer Beautification Project extended west to the waterfront, and waterfront improvements that Boulevard Jav was just talking about. The council decided this week that they would look at a proposal to raise parking taxes from 10% to 12.5%, which they think will bring in about $5 million per year, which will help to pay interest on a $70 million bond issue to get the seawall project started. Well, this is kind of interesting because earlier in the year, Mayor McGinn proposed raising the parking tax by 5 to 10%, but that money would be used about $7.8 million to fill the $7.8 million gap in the city's transportation maintenance backlog, which is starting to get pretty severe. And there's a big backlog on projects that the city is just not getting to in terms of maintaining the roadways and bridges in the city of Seattle. But the city council has pretty much ignored his proposal. They want to use an increase in the parking tax to study the seawall replacement, which I think is kind of interesting because McGinn had also proposed earlier this year a 30-year levy to raise about $241 million for the seawall construction, which would cover, you know, most of what it would cost to build a new seawall. But that he wanted that levy to go on the November ballot. It would have raised property taxes by about $50 per household. But the city council kind of poo-pooed it, saying, well, that's going to take a 60% voter approval rate for it to pass, and we don't want to separate out the seawall from the rest of the city's projects. But here you have the city saying, well, here we're going to separate out the seawall from the rest of the city's construction projects, and we're going to raise the parking rates to study how, you know, to get a bond issue going. It just doesn't make sense. And what is interesting, too, is that the council is also considering later in the year maybe looking at a levy again for the seawall. They want to do a $165 million 9-year levy that would raise property taxes by about $75 per household. So I look at this and I ask myself, okay, McGinn is proposing raising taxes too, but he wants to raise taxes by a smaller amount to do more than the city council who wants to raise taxes by a larger amount and just devote it only to the seawall and not come up with nearly the amount of money needed to do just the seawall portion of the city's expected costs. So I look at that and I go, it seems to me that McGinn should be getting a lot more support for his proposals.
All right. Moving on to national news and developments this week in regards to Proposition 8 in California.
Yeah, the federal lawsuit against Proposition 8, the ballot measure that passed a while back that outlawed the gay marriage, which had become legal in California, Proposition 8 was overturned this week by a federal judge, Judge Walker, a Reagan appointee, incidentally. And the reasoning that Walker used was a marvel of concision and brevity and clarity. It basically said that the federal government has no compelling interest in treating one class of citizens, that is heterosexuals, differently than another class of citizens, that is homosexuals, when it comes to any institution, let alone one as important as marriage. And if that stands, and it's going to go to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in the West Coast, which is generally the most liberal of the different circuits at the federal circuit level, and then from there it'll almost certainly go to the Supreme Court, which of course is much more conservative. If that ruling stands at the Supreme Court level, first of all, if it stands at the circuit court level, that would also tend to call into question Washington State's Defense of Marriage Act, the egregiously misnamed legislation that does nothing to defend marriage at all. It prohibits marriage for some people. But at that point, it would almost certainly go to the Supreme Court. Dozens and dozens of states at this point now have either laws or constitutional amendments prohibiting gay marriage, and this ruling, if it stands going up the chain of appeals, has the potential to overturn all of that. Alternatively, it also has the potential at the Supreme Court level, if you get a bad ruling by, and at this point it's really down to Justice Kennedy, whether he's going to join the four automatic conservative votes on the Supreme Court to reverse this ruling or not, it could set a precedent that would take many years and basically a new generation of Supreme Court justices in order to overturn. We got one member of that new generation this week as Elena Kagan was confirmed and will be sworn in, I believe, today, actually, as the newest Supreme Court member. But you're still going to have, at least for the next decade or so, a pretty solid five-member conservative majority on the Supreme Court. And that makes a lot of rulings very difficult, particularly around the issue of corporate power. But on a social issue like this one, it's not quite as predictable as you might think. Remember again that both for this issue and several other issues, it's been conservative appointees that have, using a fairly strict interpretation of the Constitution, said that the government has no ability to discriminate, has no right to discriminate, and has upheld it on that belief. And of course, it has conservatives all up on a lather because they want, what they want isn't a strict interpretation of the Constitution. They want constitutional changes that they agree with, whether it was in the original Constitution or not. So for the time being, a major victory, but it's going to keep going up the chain of appeals, and the stakes when it gets to the Supreme Court are going to be very, very high.
All right. From Proposition 8 to Proposition C.
Yeah, this week in Missouri, voters passed Proposition C, which is the first all-state vote within a single state, the first vote against provision of the new health care legislation that was passed by Congress earlier this year. The Proposition C was a referendum against the portion of the health care legislation that would require taxpayers to buy a... It will require folks to buy health insurance or else pay a fine. What's interesting...
It was also a resolution. It actually didn't have any binding effect.
Right, because you know, legally it doesn't have any binding effect. And that's one of the reasons why the Democrats in the Obama administration ignored Proposition C in Missouri. In fact, it turned out that about three-quarters of the Missouri population, according to a recent poll, didn't even know that Proposition C was on the ballot, much less what it was about. It was mainly an election where you had a lot of conservatives turn out because there were some hotly contested Republican candidate races, but other than that,
in the primary,
obviously it's a primary because the final election is in November. So it was mostly conservative voters that went to the poll to vote on Proposition C, and of course it passed by a wide margin. But I think it was a strategic miscalculation on the part of Democrats and supporters of the healthcare legislation to not even put up an argument against Proposition C. There was not even an argument placed in the voters' pamphlet opposing Proposition C. There was no campaign. No one came out and spoke against it. There were no radio ads or TV commercials, nothing in print. And essentially, the Obama administration and the Democrats and supporters of the healthcare legislation are putting all their eggs into the court basket. They're saying, well, you know, the courts will rule on this, and what the courts rule is what's going to stand, so we're not even going to look at these issues. Well, other states are going to be voting on this. And the problem with that is that courts can often be influenced by public opinion. So when you surrender ground in the struggle for public opinion, you are surrendering ground in the court fights as well. So I think it's a miscalculation.
And make no mistake, the whole rationale behind putting this on the ballot in the first place in a primary that was going to have a heavy Republican side turnout, because Missouri is a state where you have to be a registered Republican or a registered Democrat, the whole idea was to use this as a model for other states and other jurisdictions to use, and to be able to say, see, X percent of the people in this whole state are opposed to healthcare legislation. Well, no, it's X percent of the people who voted in a heavily conservative primary, in an election in which that particular issue didn't get a lot of attention outside the base of people that was motivated to vote on it. But, most people aren't going to be aware of those circumstances or that context. They're just going to see the final numbers, and they're just going to see that voters in the state of Missouri, quote unquote, oppose healthcare reform. And seceding that without any kind of a struggle and without any kind of contesting in the battle for public opinion, as Maria said, I think was a huge mistake.
All right, moving on to the Senate approving $26 billion.
Yeah, let's talk instead about some economic stuff.
Okay.
We're running short on time this week, and I want to get to the economic stuff that I have. There was a lot of news this week on, you know, jobs reports and interesting news about, you know, increasing unemployment, et cetera. What I found interesting about the Labor Department's report, which was often reported as the private sector hiring only 71,000 people in July. That's the number you saw in most of the reports. Well, actually, the actual report is a total loss of 131,000 jobs for July. That's the actual below-the-line total. And what that means is that, yes, the private sector hired 71,000 people in July, a very modest bump in hiring by businesses, but the public sector, the government, lost an enormous number of jobs and erased that gain entirely and moved it into negative territory. The other
piece of that shift, by the way, was that the jobs that were lost were much better paying than the jobs that were gained.
We don't know that for sure. What we know is that the jobs that were lost in the month of June, a lot of those related to temporary workers for the census. The jobs that were lost in July by government workers, some of them were temporary census workers, but the majority of them we know are permanent government employees, people who had benefits and had fairly good paying jobs. That's what I think Job is trying to say. What we also know is that the economy needs about 200,000 jobs per month to reduce the unemployment rate. So not only did not only did we not reach that goal of reducing the unemployment rate actually went up. But you'll see in reports that it remains the same. The news reports will say, well, the unemployment rate remains the same at 9.5%. What they're not telling you is that the underemployment rate, which includes the unemployed, people who are have officially filed and are collecting unemployment, plus the people who have been discouraged or they've been unemployed so long they can no longer collect benefits, or or people who are working only part-time and are still looking for a full-time job, that rate is at 16.5% and maybe higher. It's difficult to get a real total number on that because it's difficult to know how many people have dropped out of the workforce versus who have died or who have become or who have left the country, et cetera, et cetera. But that's the real jobs report that we didn't get this week. There were a couple of other very interesting reports, too, that Americans are spending less. They are also saving more. Usually in a mild downturn, what Americans do is they decide, well, we will spend a little less and pay down our debt, hoping that when things pick up, we can spend again. When they get really pessimistic, Americans tend to spend less, pay down their debt, and start saving more. And so what we're seeing is people thinking, well, oh my God, I could lose my job too. Things are not looking so good. The economy may be in a prolonged downturn. I not only have to pay off my debt, I have to build up a little bit of savings so that I have a cushion in case something goes wrong. So that's a very interesting thing that we saw this week. The American savings rates have approximately doubled, if not tripled, since the beginning of the downturn. And I think that's pointing to the fact that Americans are not gonna sort of wake up and start spending and accounting for a big uptick in economic activity. Remember, consumer spending accounts for somewhere between 66 and 80% of all economic activity in the U.S. Numbers, estimates vary according to which economist you're listening to. So that's a bigger picture of what's going on, at our level of the economy, not at the upper levels of, say, the corporations and the high-flying economists. But what we're hearing a lot lately is talk about deficits and deflation and the Bush tax cuts. Well, the Republicans are saying deficits are bad because if the deficit gets too high, investors who buy bonds will look at U.S. government bonds and say, well, it's too risky to buy them, and the cost for the U.S. government to borrow will go up. Bond prices will fall, and they'll have to, which means interest rates will go up and so forth. Deflation, on the other hand, is when people start saving. Like I said, people are saving more. Well, that means more demand for quality investments like bonds. So the demand for bonds is very high. In addition, worldwide, people are looking for quality investments because of the problems that they've had in the past with different types of credit investments like mortgage-backed securities, et cetera. And they're looking more towards U.S. government bonds and European government bonds, but selected European government bonds like Germany and France, et cetera, not Greece and Spain. But so they're looking for quality. So there's a very high demand for U.S. government bonds. So that risk that the Republicans are talking about with the high deficit is not as big a risk as they're saying. So what enters into this then is the Bush tax cuts. The Congress has to act sometime this summer on whether or not to renew the Bush tax cuts, or else they'll completely expire. At the same time, you have the Democrats saying, well, we don't want to raise taxes on the lower and middle class. We want to raise taxes on the higher classes. And the Republicans saying, oh, no, we should renew all of the Bush tax cuts because any tax increase will sink the economy. Well, the truth is some may lie somewhere in between. We can talk about that future shows.
Talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
The election issue of Eat the State is out with all the endorsements and more, the ones that we mentioned early on in the show. You can find that wherever you find free publications, bookstores, libraries, King County Library System, et cetera, coffee shops. And you can also find it online, including the endorsement article. That's the lead article this week at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, feedback, we didn't say nice things or we did say nice things about the candidate you like most, you can email us at info@eatthestate.org.